Welcome to EIR Talks. This week we present the LaRouche Connection, an audio-video news magazine produced by Executive Intelligence Review, which was founded in 1974 by Lyndon H. LaRouche.
It's Wednesday, April 10th, 2002. My name is Jeff Steinberg. Welcome to another edition of the LaRouche Connection. In recent weeks, in the face of mounting dangers of a general war in the Middle East, the ever-present threat of a final collapse of the global financial and monetary system, Lyndon LaRouche has once again emerged as perhaps the single most important politician and statesman alive today. It's in this context that we broadcast the overview tape from hearings that took place in August and September of 1995 on the subject of tyranny on the part of the U.S. Department of Justice, including the railroad prosecution, conviction, and jailing of Lyndon LaRouche.
And I think it's bound to become one of the most egregious cases in the harassment and abuse of a black elected official in the history of the United States Justice Department.
And they come in with a bankruptcy claim, a false bankruptcy claim against nonprofit publishing houses and shut them down. What's the First Amendment worth, you know?
You don't get any respect, even if you try to work with them. They manipulate and use you, and when they're finished, they cast you away.
At this particular case, the Justice Department is much worse of a villain than the KGB.
And what Theo said earlier about I love my country, but I'm afraid of my government. Something's very wrong here, people.
On November 17, 1993, the U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the U.S. Department of Justice had committed fraud upon the court by falsely and maliciously prosecuting retired auto worker John Demjanjuk, a court decision which finally closed a 17-year ordeal which almost resulted in Demjanjuk's execution. Even more shocking, the same corrupt members of the Justice Department's permanent bureaucracy have been found to be at the center of many other cases in which there is indisputable proof of gross prosecutorial misconduct. On August 31st and September 1st, 1995, a distinguished panel of American legislators and international observers held extraordinary hearings to investigate the Justice Department's politically motivated and illegal targeting of groups and individuals. The panel included Representative William Clark of Alabama, Representative Toby Fitch of North Carolina, Senator Robert Ford of South Carolina, Senator Maggie Wallace Glover of South Carolina, Monsignor Elias L. Hayek of Montreal, Representative John Hilliard of Alabama, Representative Howard Hunter of North Carolina, Representative Ulysses Jones Jr. of Tennessee, and Representative Percy Watson of Mississippi. The hearings were observed by Dr. Kofi Awanor, former ambassador to the United Nations of the Republic of Ghana, Marino El Savif of the Dominican Republic, Dr. Josef Mikloško, former vice premier of the Republic of Czechoslovakia, and noted civil rights leader Amelia Boynton Robinson. The first day's sessions were largely devoted to one of the ugliest stories in U.S. judicial history, the campaign to harass, entrap, and prosecute every African-American elected official in America. This was followed by the case of Lyndon LaRouche, often referred to as the American Dreyfus, which included testimony from attorney Odin Anderson, LaRouche himself, and former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. The Demjanjuk case was detailed by his Israeli attorney, Yoram Sheftel, who risked his own life to save his client from the hangman. And Dr. Hans Köckler, president of the International Progress Organization, described how former UN General Secretary Kurt Waldheim, when he became president of Austria, also became a target of a corrupt unit within the U.S. Department of Justice. The hearings were chaired by former South Carolina Congressman James Mann and by Alabama's most renowned civil rights attorney, J.L. Chestnut.
This is an independent panel of my distinguished colleagues from all over this country who have come to this place at this time to investigate allegations of misconduct by the United States Department of Justice generally, and in particular their targeting of black elected officials.
It is something that has never been done before, to tell the story of the African-American, and certainly the African-American politician. And now the time has come for you to hear from some of us who have suffered the pain, the indignities and humiliations, and the destructions of our families, our professions, and our businesses. As a public official in 1982, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Department, which some of us are familiar with Waco, Texas, and the Branch Davidians, conspired with the Ku Klux Klan to set up and to have me charged with violating the Food Stamp Act of the United States of America. This resulted in a trial which the FBI records reflect that they knew that the Ku Klux Klan had been after me since 1979. In 1994, in my race for lieutenant governor, as I indicated, we were doing quite well. In a statewide race that I was the only black candidate. And after a run off and a poll projection, it showed that I was a very viable candidate to possibly be the next lieutenant governor of South Carolina. I was hit between the eyes with a ton of bricks from something that had happened 6 years prior to this race. A client of mine, I had represented him in 1988 in the purchase of some real estate. Not being familiar with the pattern of the federal government, after being told by the purchaser that they would pay the taxes, we did not file form 8300s. $10,000 more. Consequently, they reached back and they threatened to charge me and two former secretaries with money laundering and conspiracy to commit money laundering.
One point of clarification, I understand.
On your failing to file the form, were you the closing attorney in the purchase of land?
I was the closing attorney in 1988 for a seven-installment transaction for a man who bought $154,000 in property. And he made payments, and the money was brought through the office and directly given to the seller. I never touched it, but it came through my office. He didn't pay the taxes. He didn't file the forms. So when they had a chance to hit me with a truckload of bricks, they did.
And you weren't even present when those transactions was done.
What's a form 8300?
An 8300 is a form which should be filed within 2 weeks after a person has transferred $10,000 or more in cash to the Internal Revenue.
Transferred from where to where?
Well, basically, you handled it.
You know, I look at you, and I look at other African Americans and legislators across the country and say that we could very easily switch roles. I could very easily be sitting there. Right. And I realize that every day that I walk into the legislative chamber and even begin to think about fighting some of this racist legislation that is passing.
In 1993, you were the only African-American chairman of a Senate committee, standing committee, and that committee was Correction and Penology. One of the things that you was able to do as chairman of the committee was to stop a lot of legislation, mean-spirit legislation, from going on the floor of the Senate.
Senator Ford is right. The no parole, all of this great, tough, mean-spirited legislation which came to our committee, you can see the racial overtones in it. It was just clear, just like a newspaper. So consequently, we put out what was fair legislation, and we resisted and held up that which we felt was inequitable and unfair and certainly mean-spirited. We feel good about our heart. We were told that if we had resigned the chair, we may well not have been expelled.
I'm glad to see you express the desire or the feeling that it happened to you because you did something. And I guess we all, both Hilliard and Jones and I, both looked at it from the same standpoint. You kind of skirted it and dressed it up originally. And I just want to make sure that this record is clear that if you go and you do nothing, you're a good guy. But if you go and you make a ripple in the water, that's where you have the problems.
I was one of three who were the first three blacks elected to the South Carolina House since the Reconstruction period. Jim Felder, I.S. Levy Johnson, and I were elected in 1970, and we started serving in January of 1971. Personally, after many, many confrontations, practically on a daily basis, with the Speaker of the House, in 1973, I was charged with failure to file an income tax return, and I was sentenced to 1 year in jail and a $10,000 fine. In 1974, 13 blacks were elected to the South Carolina House of Representatives. Senator Mitchell was one of those 13. In 1984, well, I resigned from the House when I was sentenced, but I came back to the House in 1982. And in 1984, we got single-member districts to the Senate, and four of us were elected at that time. By July of 1990, there were five of us blacks in the South Carolina Senate and 16 blacks in the South Carolina House. Now, several of the members of the House particularly had advanced to key positions of leadership, and there were many others who were close to key positions of leadership. And that was when the explosion came down. 18 legislators were targeted in what has now come to be known as Operation Lost Trust. Five of the convictions have been overturned by the Fourth Circuit Court. The original federal judge is now seriously considering the charges of prosecutorial abuse and is in the process of going over boxes of evidence which had been withheld from the defendants at the time of their trials.
I would like, prior to making comments, to give you somewhat of a further backdrop of this whole Operation Lost Trust and at least the African-American members of our state delegation who were involved. And to the person, I think Luther Taylor was first vice chairperson. Luther Taylor was the first one tried. He was first vice chairperson of the Education Committee. No, I think it was Banking Committee, Banking and Insurance, a very, very powerful committee in our state. And Luther apparently had been negotiated out of running for chairperson at some point. And the reason I mentioned that, he was a powerful personality on that committee, and I think would have won the chairperson's election had he been there next time around. You had, of course, at that time, Representative McBride, seated to my extreme left. I think Frank was first vice chairperson of Education Committee. Operations and Management. You had Representative Jim Faber, who's not here from South Carolina. He was first vice chairperson, I think, of the Agriculture Committee. You had Representative Larry Blandy, who had already acquired enough votes to win a seat on our state Employment Security Commission. Of course, I had was ultimately won a seat on our state circuit court. From Spartanburg County, that's the highest trial court in our state. And I'm trying to recall, you had Representative B.J. Gordon, who was the ranking Democratic member of the our House Ways and Means Committee. You had Representative Ennis Fant from Greenville, South Carolina, Congressman Mann's County, and of course, Senator Mitchell's county. Representative Fan, in my view, was one of the brightest people whom I saw come to the legislature while I was there. He was the driving force behind putting together an accommodations law in our state, which prior thereto had none. Extremely knowledgeable in the banking and real estate areas. A young man who put together a patent while he worked at one of the chemical companies there in the state that the company later bought from him. Just a dynamic personality. I'm satisfied was well on his way
to becoming one of the determining factors in our state. And at 27 years old, and I'm trying to think if I'm leaving out any. Of course, from Orangeburg County, you had Representative Ken Bailey. And Ken was a very well respected member of not only the Black Caucus but the General Assembly as well. So this wasn't just an arbitrary kind of thing of just going after blacks. It went after blacks who were in decision-making positions and people who were very well poised to become chairmen and chairpersons of important committees. And I think they were one election away.
There were seven criteria for a person to be a target in a federal investigation. And one very important one is a predisposition. And a person has to be predisposed to a crime before you can make him a target. I certainly wasn't, and none of my other colleagues that I know of was. So the government was definitely wrong here in targeting many of us without us being predisposed to a crime. The other thing is, now all eight African Americans that were targeted and eventually indicted with this pari-mutuel betting bill had been sponsors of this bill for years.
In 1985, Ronald Reagan's Justice Department came to Alabama and returned 126 indictments or charges against carefully selected black leaders. Each one was charged with something called vote fraud. I had a meeting with Edwin Meese, who was then the Attorney General of the United States, and asked him what was vote fraud. He didn't know. I didn't know. We raised some money, not much. But then we got our folk together. Those who were charged, we reminded them of what had occurred in Alabama in the 1960s. They had to be ready to die if necessary, go to jail, whatever. They had to be ready to turn a town inside out, upside down. We had to be prepared to boycott, march, demonstrate, do whatever. And we tried every damn case, every one. And the government won only one. And that one was reversed on appeal on grounds of selective prosecution. And the government refused to retry.
The effect of what they do is so devastating. It's so far-reaching. It destroys our hopes, our dreams, our promises. If this isn't stopped now, because it should have been addressed when Congressman Dimely, back in the late 70s, early 80s, introduced this to the Black Caucus and into the congressional record, that the Operation Frumention was an official policy of the FBI and what it does to people, black people especially. If it would have been addressed then, if black people across this nation, especially black leaders who had been victimized, if they would have put support, put money, because he tried to open a center for harassment against black elected officials, but he couldn't get support. If this would have happened, then these men and myself would not be here today.
Members of the panel, I've been asked to present to you an overview of the case known as the United States of America versus Harold E. Ford. Fourth case I submit to you, panelists, will be an essay on prosecutorial misconduct, and I think is bound to become one of the most egregious cases in the harassment and abuse of a black elected official in the history of the United States Justice Department. Congressman Ford weathered a 10-year ordeal of government abuse and harassment. The attack first surfaced in 1983 and continued to the 58 count indictment on various bank fraud charges on April 24th of 1987, then to the first trial on February 12th, 1990, which ended in a mistrial after 22 days of testimony, 29 witnesses, 150 trial exhibits, 110 pages of jury instructions, and 12 hours and 35 minutes of jury deliberations, and several hundred thousand dollars by the congressman. The congressman was retried in April of 93 in Jackson, Tennessee, outside his home county and congressional district. And this is what I think, and this is one of the things that happened in Mr. LaRouche's case, you have the government shopping for a venue, you know. And when you have no case, you have to resort to tricks and manipulate the system. But we get back to the trial in Jackson, Tennessee. And it went on with predominantly white jury. But with a vigorous defense and with the exposure of the government's case, the government didn't even have the witnesses to prove conspiracy. And of course, as Judge Ferguson indicated, conspiracy is a tool that the government is using to abuse black elected officials. But in this case, the alleged co-conspirators were not available, or the government didn't want to risk their presentation. So the case caved in after Congressman Ford had spent several million dollars, and the government had probably spent 10 times as much as he had spent. And so he was finally acquitted of all of the charges, all of the charges against him.
The record will show that for the last 20 years, Richard Arrington Jr. has been a constant target for prosecution. I happen to believe that much of that prosecution probably was at the hand of our government. I heard the statement today for the first time that I love my country, but I fear my government. I'm afraid I'm going to have to subscribe to that statement.
For the record, Richard Arrington is the black mayor of Birmingham, and he has been subjected to 10 years of intensive investigations by the federal government. And that was a terrible trial there. The mayor was in contempt of court and sent to federal prison. J.L. Chestnut never cooperated. When I say the government, I'm talking about the Justice Department. Never cooperated with him. The end of all of that was that the government didn't even indict Mayor Arrington, much less convict him. And that was it. But once again, it required one hell of a fight. Once again, it required that those in power understand that this is not just a fight in the courtroom. It's going to be up and down the streets of Alabama. It's going to invoke boycotts and reminiscence of the 1960s and every damn thing else we can come up with. This is not going to be a situation here where you're going to stomp on us and we're going to say, "Yasser boss, no way." And that is the only way we got out of that. Except for that, Dick Arrington would be the ex-mayor of Birmingham.
Mr. LaRouche apparently wasn't African-American and apparently wasn't Jewish. I mean, why LaRouche? Who was he? Because I have no idea on what you're basically saying. The picture is not clear to me.
I think he will far more eloquently than I can probably tell you who he is and what he stands for. He's going to be here.
See the government going after, you know, us. But who is Mr. LaRouche and why the government?
For basically the same reasons they're going after you. They don't like what he stands for and they don't like what he's doing. He just doesn't happen to be black.
Law enforcement, prosecution, media, and non-governmental organizations focus on destroying an enemy. This case must be number one. There are some where the government itself may have done more and more wrongfully over a period of time. But the very networking and combination of federal, state, and local agencies, of executive and even some legislative and judicial branches, of major media and minor local media, and of influential lobbyist types, the ADL preeminently. This case takes the prize.
Probably the best way to demonstrate the government's venal behavior and the unconstitutional activities undertaken, right, directed out of the criminal division of the Department of Justice, is to show you their own documents and read to you their own words. And by way of history, I'd like to have the screen. What you see before you is an FBI memorandum from the SAC, who is the special agent in charge of the New York field office of the FBI, to the director regarding, and the name subject, Lyndon Hermeel LaRouche Jr., also known as Lynn Marcus, as they suggest. This is the most incredible piece of FBI material, one of the most incredible pieces of FBI material that I've ever seen.
CPUSA.
We're Communist Party. I'm going to get it. That's the Communist Party of the United States. What this suggests is that the Communist Party has let the FBI know that they want to eliminate Lyndon LaRouche for their political reasons. They consider him to be a politically dangerous person, and the Communist Party wants to eliminate him. If you look at the bottom, New York proposes submitting a blind memorandum to the
Daily World
to foster these efforts. Is the FBI climbing in bed with the Communist Party in order to effect the elimination of Lyndon LaRouche from the political scene? I think we all know what that means.
You're listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with the LaRouche Connection, produced by Executive Intelligence Review.
Moving into the 80s, Henry Kissinger, who we all know by name and some probably remember by reputation and actions, was a very powerful man. Mr. LaRouche took exception with his policies, which he considered to be genocidal. And Mr. Kissinger, if you put up the next overlay, writes to, on his letterhead, to William Webster, the director of the FBI. They had recently had a lovely social occasion together at the place called the Grove, where these powers associate and frolic around in various curious ways. Appreciates the having seen him there, and asks for the assistance of Bill Webster in dealing with the LaRouche menace. If we can go to the next overlay, Buck Revell, who was the head of counterintelligence for the FBI, is sent this memorandum by William Webster, who was contacted by David Abshire of PIFIAB. That's the president's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. And the same Party's Henry Kissinger and his colleagues are now raising before PIFIAB the question as to whether LaRouche, because he seems to have funding from sources that they don't understand, is possibly operating as a foreign intelligence agent, and they want them to look into this. Now, what that does, and the, you know, the words are bad enough, but the reality is terrifying. This triggers Executive Order 12333, which allows virtually any form of conduct, any activity, to be undertaken as long as it's under this national security cover. So this was the beginning of a national security covered operation against Mr. LaRouche and his colleagues. Why do we have these documents? Not because they gave them to us. They hid these from us, and they fight us at every turn. But we've been able to obtain through discovery in a number of cases that have been brought, including a case directly against the FBI alleging this misconduct on a past and continuing basis, have been able to obtain certain proofs of the actions that we knew happened but couldn't show you the documents for. Now we have some. The common denominator between all of these cases is twofold. It's, as I said, political targeting, and it's the criminal division of the Justice Department. It's, can't think, imagine a more frightening thing than to realize that among the worst abuses of our constitutional rights as a people and for individuals, that they're being, in fact, planned and directed out of the very heart of the agency that's supposed to be protecting those rights.
These are book people. They had publishing houses going on, important publications, nonprofit stuff. The government comes in and these are just some of the peripheral things that Odin and others might not have explained to you. But these are what they were about: ideas, information, social change, meeting the needs of human people all over the world, humanity all over the world. We're going to have a billion more people before the end of this millennium, century, decade, and the vast majority, 80% of them, are going to have beautiful, darker skin, and they're going to live short lives of sickness, hunger, pain, ignorance, and violence unless we act radically. And these books have ideas. Some will work, some won't work, but they're ideas. They can be tested in the marketplace, as we used to say. And they come in with a bankruptcy claim, a false bankruptcy claim against nonprofit publishing houses, and shut them down.
The Demjanjuk affair started as a Soviet plot in the very beginning of 1976. Through a Soviet crony named Michael Hanushak, which is an editor, used to be an editor, of a Ukrainian communist newspaper published in New York under the name of the Ukrainian Daily News. The affair started by an attempt to implicate Demjanjuk for being a guard in the notorious death camp of Sobibor. Sobibor, it's worthwhile to mention, is a death camp which between spring of 1942 to the autumn of 1943, 600,000 Jews were slaughtered there in front of the Allies, which knew exactly what happened there and didn't lift a finger to save even one Jewish child from the Holocaust. However, on the way of the Demjanjuk affair from being a case of mistaken identity to a vicious show trial, it became one of the worst cases of cover-up in modern history. And this is due to the enormous, unprecedented misconduct of the Department of Justice, more specifically, the Office of Special Investigation, which is a body within the Justice Department. I will focus in my presentation in that part of the Demjanjuk affair only, because I think this is what is in the interest of this panel to find out. The lawsuit against Demjanjuk to revoke his American citizenship was produced to the Cleveland Federal Court in September 1977. Although the sole proof against Demjanjuk were identification from this extremely suggestive photo spread, still there can be no doubt that the Justice Department did believe genuinely in September 1977 that Demjanjuk is that monster from Treblinka known as Ivan the Terrible by the unfortunate Jews that worked as slaves in that camp. But less than a year after this indictment of Demjanjuk was presented to the federal court in Cleveland, the OSI received through the American Embassy in Moscow material, to be precise, at the 12th of August 1978. And this material was a telegram with 100 pages of documents which were requested by the OSI in connection with another case altogether, to the case of John Demjanjuk, a case which the OSI conducted and lost in the matter of Fyodor Fedorenko. If you would expect, as everyone else would expect, that they will review their position due to the new material which they have in their possession, which of course prove beyond any doubt that Demjanjuk cannot be Ivan the Terrible, the OSI didn't do it. They also didn't terminate the case. And they decided to continue with it as nothing happens, as all this material is not in their possession, and they decided to continue with the case to revoke Demjanjuk's American citizenship for being a man which they knew very well at this stage that he isn't, Ivan the Terrible. They knew very well that there is no way whatsoever that Demjanjuk can be Ivan the Terrible. Yet they decided to proceed with the case. From the dozens of bureaucrats of the OSI, at this stage, one, George Parker, became alert of what's happening. And he wrote a 5-page memorandum explaining why there is no case whatsoever against Demjanjuk in any allegation or charges whatsoever, the Soviet-initiated ones or those which exploded in Israel due to the mistaken identity proceedings through the suggestive photo spreads. Now, not only he wrote a memorandum and sent it to the head of the OSI at the time, Alan Ryan, but he asked an interview with Alan Ryan and tried to persuade him to drop the case, not to proceed with the case. We are talking now at the very end of 1980, October 1980, the proceedings against Demjanjuk in court not yet started, the actual hearings of evidence. He was not listened to. And the proceedings started as nothing happened in February 1981. When George Parker realized that that is what's going to happen, he decided to quit the OSI. He felt that he cannot take part in this frame-up on one hand and cover-up on the other hand. And he quit the OSI. Now, he revealed all those facts in an interview he gave to NBC television in November 1991, 11 years later. However, my strong position is that George Parker is not better, and in some aspects even worse, than the bureaucrats of the OSI, because he wanted to wash his hands of physically bringing the execution of Demjanjuk for being what he is not. But he made this thing possible to happen because In February 1981, when the proceedings took place, he kept his mouth shut. Now, in 1986, 28th of February, Demjanjuk was extradited to the State of Israel because the U.S. court ruled that he's even the terrible. Parker knew he's not. Parker knew he's facing now a death penalty. He kept his mouth shut. In 25th of April 1988, Demjanjuk was sentenced to death for one reason only, for being Ivan the Terrible. And again, George Parker keeps his mouth shut. He only opened his mouth in November 1991, when everything was revealed by the defense. When we went in September 1990 to the Soviet Union and got the documents, 80 of them, which proves unequivocally that Ivan Marchenko is Ivan the Terrible. When Demjanjuk was finally extradited to the State of Israel through proceedings of the OSI in the 28th of February 1986, few weeks later, his son-in-law, Ed Nishnik, filed a lawsuit based on FOIA to get the entire file, the entire dossier about Demjanjuk, which is in the possession of the OSI. And we have a memo written to Martin Zaks, which is one of the trial attorneys of the OSI, by no other than Bruce Einhorn, the lead attorney in the proceedings in the Cleveland case. And this is what he writes. I can state unequivocally that we should oppose release of our files for the following reasons. Concern over the integrity of the Israeli prosecution. Release of our material now would in all probability reveal and could easily undermine and prejudice the Israeli prosecution strategy. What is this strategy? To execute Demjanjuk for being Ivan the Terrible, while he knows that he is not, and he doesn't want to undermine that strategy, to hang someone where he knows that he is not that man that he's going to be hanged for. Is that what he's saying, black on white in writing? And Judge Thomas Weissman held extensive hearings in the second half of 1992 and the first half of 1993, and came out with a devastating report at the 29th of June 1993. And based on this devastating report of Judge Thomas Weissman, at the 17th of November 1993, the Federal Court of Appeal for the Sixth Circuit decided as follows, after totally disbelief to everything the OSI people told him during these proceedings. Now, of course, I will not read to you the entire decision, but small, very important, relevant parts. The OSI attorney acted with reckless disregard for their duty to the court and their discovery obligations in failing to disclose at least three sets of documents in their possession before the proceedings against Demjanjuk ever reached trial, because they are in their possession from 78, as we saw, and the trial proceedings started only in 81. And then the court concludes, thus we hold that the OSI attorney acted with reckless disregard for the truth and for the government obligation to take no steps that prevent an adversary from presenting his case fully and fairly. This was fraud on the court in the circumstances of this case. And finally, as a result of all this, for the reasons set out herein, we vacate the judgment of the district court and the judgment of this court in the extradition proceedings on the ground that the judgments were wrongly procured as a result of a prosecutorial misconduct that constituted fraud on the court. Black and white. In the most unequivocal terms possible. Now, Ellen Ryan gave an interview to an Alabama newspaper called the Huntsville Times. in the 30th of October, 1991. And that's what he has to say. It was one of the first cases, he referred to the Demjanjuk case, the first cases we tried. And we were very much on the line. If we had lost that case, we probably would have had very short lifespan. In other words, in order to prolong the lifespan of the OSI, they choose to shorten the lifespan of the Demjanjuk.
Let us recall the situation in the year 1986. Dr. Waldheim was back since 82 to Austria. He left the office of Secretary General of the United Nations in 82. He was named presidential candidate by the Austrian People's Party in 85 for the elections in 86. We think that for political reasons he became a target because as Secretary General of the United Nations he was involved in the implementation of United Nations policies concerning the question of Palestine, and he served as Secretary General in a crucial time of big confrontations between the Arab world and the advocates of Palestinian rights on the one side and the State of Israel and of course the pro-Israeli lobby and the American administration on the other side. It was a kind of political campaign in order to isolate and to discredit Austria and in order to force Austria to abandon this political orientation which was established by the late Bruno Kreisky. There were secret contacts. Certain functionaries, political functionaries in Austria thought they could destroy Mr. Waldheim's candidacy with the help of this certain establishment here, namely, of course, the World Jewish Congress headed by Mr. Bronfman. That played a big role in the media campaign against Mr. Waldheim, and then the legal structure here as represented by the Office of Special Investigation. We got many statements from the American media, statements from Mr. Bronfman and other leading figures in this country telling us, telling the Austrian people, if you elect this man, if you elect this criminal, then your economy will suffer. There will be no tourists from the United States, will be boycotted, so and so on. As far as the decision of the Office of Special Investigation is concerned to place the name of Kurt Waldheim on the so-called watch list, the whole procedures were carried out secretly. In spite of Mr. Waldheim's repeated efforts and in spite of the Austrian government's repeated efforts, never did the Department of Justice disclose the nature of the allegations. Never did they show him or the Austrian government or the Austrian embassy here any documents.
Are you saying to us that one government, the United States, declared the president, the head of state of another government, to be a war criminal, and the second government, through official sources, asked the United States government for clarification and the basis on which it reached that conclusion, and the United States government refused to provide that information?
Yes. That's what you're saying. For 7 years, Austria has been denied these informations, and in 94, the Ministry of Justice on its own published this report here. I mean, it made it public 7 years after.
We have, in my view, a system of injustice whose center is within the Department of Justice, especially the criminal division of the U.S. Department of Justice. The problem lies not with one administration or another, though one administration or another may act more positively or more negatively. You have permanent civil service employees like Deputy Assistant Attorney General Jack Keeney and Mark Richard, who are coordinators of a nest of institutions in the criminal division, which show up repeatedly as leading or key associates of every legal atrocity which I've seen. This is the case with the so-called True Mention operation, which is largely an FBI operation, but cannot run without cooperation from these people and their assistance. The case of the Demoniac case, which is outstanding, of a man who they, according to the Sixth Circuit, a man who the Justice Department knew to be innocent of the charges they were making against him at the time they made the charges. And yet Mark Richard and Jack Keeney and so forth proceeded with that case, an attempt to secure the execution of this man in Israel over the objections of the Israeli government for an OSI operation which was set into place by Henry Kissinger some years before. You have the case of the Weaver case, the same thing. The much celebrated case of the Waco case, the same complex of injustice. We have an out-of-control Justice Department, in my view, where the rot is not in the appointees as much as it is in the permanent bureaucracy. We have a permanent sickness in the permanent bureaucracy of part of our government. In my case, when the time came that somebody wanted me out of the way, they were able to rely upon that permanent injustice in the permanent bureaucracy of government to do the job. As in the Frumenschen case, the Weaver case, the Waco case, the case of Waldheim, the case of Demoniac, in other cases, always there's that agency inside the Justice Department which works for contract like a hitman when somebody with the right credentials and passwords walks in and says, we want to get this group of people or we want to get this person.
You and I had a little chat in Selma, Alabama, and you were saying to me that, well, I had raised to you about affirmative action. And I think your phrase was that it was a red herring. And I didn't get a chance to say to you that it is a red herring, but whole states are buying it. And for a little black fella sitting off 20% of the population, this government has not been in touch with me since Lyndon Johnson said he wouldn't run again. And I had a lot of reservations about him. But sitting back as a little black fella, and I see entire states marching in lockstep and accepting this red herring as gospel, I guess you can understand that even somebody like me sometimes feel overwhelmed and whether or not America is just a lost cause. I hate to sound that way, but after 40 years, I got serious reservations about whether we can save this country, about whether this country even wants to be saved.
Well, I take an evangelical view of this. I've been associated with many lost causes in my life, as you have.
Yeah.
And once in a while, we win them. We have the means, and government has the means, to turn it around. When enough people in this country stand up on their hind legs and stop voting for what they don't want, or for a result they don't want. And I think that if the problem of people, as I see it, is people don't trust the leadership. And I don't blame them for not trusting their leadership. I blame them for being too pessimistic. And it's up to us and others to get enough people moving to create a movement. Like the case just of Martin Luther King. Now, I never personally met Martin Luther King, but I watched him closely. And I know something about Martin Luther King from people who knew him and his circumstances. And here's a man. He's a good man. He's a preacher, Baptist preacher. I don't know. They run to this way and that way. But one day somebody appointed him, nominated him to be a leader of the civil rights movement, out of a crowd, so to speak. He took the job as an appointee, like a federal appointee. Only this was a civil rights movement. He went from crisis to crisis in a few years from the time that he received that appointment until he went to his death, knowing he was facing death. And in that period of time, he made a number of public speeches of great power and pith. Each of those speeches corresponded to a point of crisis in the history of the civil rights movement. And I saw on television, and I read in the recorded speeches, I read a man who had gone into private, into his own Gethsemane, probably inspired by reading the New Testament, and said, I will drink of this cup. And he came out with an idea, with a lot of people swarming around him, but he came out with the idea. And he presented a concept which took a whole people who were looking to him in the civil rights movement, and he ennobled them. He said, you're not fighting for African-American rights, you're fighting for everybody's rights. You're fighting to make the Constitution real. And it was a new idea, a different idea. And as he did with his mountain speech that he gave just before he went, again, a man who had walked into Gethsemane and said, yes, Lord, I will drink of this cup as my Savior before me. And he went out and he drank of the cup and he inspired people. Now, we don't know who among us is going to be the great leader of this period. But we know, as the civil rights people of the 1960s, who had been in the civil rights business for many centuries, in point of fact, many of the conscious family tradition, they assembled together. They picked people from their midst as leaders. And among these leaders was a Martin Luther King. And I think if enough of us assemble today around these kinds of issues and show the nation that there is something moving, something which is of concern to the average citizen, that from among those we gather, together for that purpose, we will find the leaders we need.
You've been listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.